Chapter 12. Paris and the New Order. The Peace Congress was scheduled to begin at the French Foreign Ministry on the Quai d'Orsay in the afternoon of the 25th of February. By midday, a large and excited crowd of spectators had gathered along the Quai d'Orsay to watch the arrival of the delegates. Stretching from the Pont de la Concorde to the Rue d'Iéna, the onlookers had to be kept back by infantrymen and the gendarmerie to allow the carriages of the foreign dignitaries to pass by and pull up outside the newly completed buildings of the Foreign Ministry. The delegates arrived from 1 o'clock, each one cheered with cries of "Vive la paix" and "Vive l'Empereur" as they stepped out and entered into the building. Dressed in morning coats, the delegates assembled in the magnificent Hall of Ambassadors, where a large round table covered with green velvet and 12 armchairs around it had been laid out for the conference. The hall was a showcase for the decorative arts of the Second Empire. Satin crimson drapes hung from the walls. The only pictures were life-size portraits of Napoleon III and the Empress Eugenie, whose dominating gaze was a constant reminder to the delegates of France's new position as the arbiter of international affairs. On a console by the fireplace was a marble bust of Napoleon I, persona non grata in diplomatic circles for more than 40 years. The Paris Congress marked what Napoleon III wanted to believe was the return of Napoleonic France to the concert of Europe. The choice of Paris as the venue for the Congress was a sign of France's new position as the preeminent power on the continent. The only other city where it might have taken place was Vienna, where the 1815 treaty had been signed. But the idea was rejected by the British, who had been suspicious of the diplomatic efforts of the Austrians since the beginning of the war. With diplomatic power shifting briefly to Paris, Vienna now appeared a city of the past. "Who could deny that France comes out of all this enlarged?" wrote Count Walewski to Napoleon after learning that he would become the host of the Congress. "France alone will have profited in this struggle. Today she holds first place in Europe." The Congress came only 3 months after the ending of the Exposition Universelle, a glittering international event rivaling London's Great Exhibition of 1851. 5 million visitors had made their way through the exhibition halls on the Champs-Élysées. The two events placed Paris at the centre of Europe. This was a major victory for Napoleon III, whose decision to enter the war had always been influenced by his need for prestige at home and abroad. From the start of the peace talks the previous autumn, he had emerged as the key player, on whom all the other powers depended for the satisfaction of their interests. "I am struck by the general deference to the Emperor Napoleon," wrote Princess Liefen to Baroness Mayendorf on the 9th of November. "The war has carried him pretty high, him and France. It has not enhanced England." Peace talks had been going on throughout the winter, and by the time the delegates arrived in Paris, most of the controversial issues had already been resolved. The main sticking point was the tough stance of the British, who were in no hurry to end a war in which they had not had a major victory to satisfy their honour and justify their losses of the previous 18 months. The capture of Sevastopol had, after all, been a French success. Urged on by a belligerent press and public, Palmerston reiterated the minimum conditions he had set out on the 9th of October and threatened to keep on with the war, starting with a spring campaign in the Baltic, if the Russians failed to come to peace on British terms. He pressed Clarendon, his foreign secretary, to accept nothing less than complete Russian submission to his conditions at the Paris Congress. Despite his assertions, Palmerston's demands were in a state of flux. By November, he had given up on the idea of securing independence for Circassia. No representative from that confused territory could be found to sign a treaty on its behalf. Yet he continued to insist that Russia should be deprived of the Caucasus and Central Asia, and was adamant that British firmness could obtain this. "Russia was negotiating from a weak position," he wrote to Clarendon on the 25th of February, "and was showing impudence by arguing against the latest version of the British terms. the complete removal of Russian ships and arsenals from the Black Sea, and the evacuation of every part of Turkish territory, including Kars, now occupied by Russian troops. These conditions, Palmerston maintained, were not dishonourable to Russia, but only calculated to be manifest and patent pledges of the sincerity of her disclaimer of aggressive intentions. Warning Clarendon about Count Orlov, the leader of the Russian delegation to Paris, he revealed his Russophobic attitudes. "As to Orlov, I know him well. He is civil and courteous externally, but his inward mind is deeply impregnated with Russian insolence, arrogance, and pride. He will do his best to bully without appearing to do so. He will stand out for every point which he thinks he has a chance of carrying, and he has all the cunning of a half-civilized savage." The French and the Italians were disgusted by Palmerston's behaviour. Victor Emmanuel, the Piedmontese king, described him as a rabid animal. Eager for peace, the French did not share the British inclination to punish Russia. They needed a rapprochement with the Russians to realise Napoleon's plans in Italy. Sympathetic to the cause of Italian unification, the French emperor calculated that he could retain Savoy and Nice, captured by the French in 1792, but returned to Piedmont by the Congress of Vienna in 1815, by helping the Piedmontese to conquer Lombardy-Venetia from the Austrians and expel the Habsburgs from the rest of Italy. Requiring the support or armed neutrality of the Russians to defeat the Austrians, the French were unwilling to go along with Palmerston's punitive initiatives against Russia. Their main point of difference with the British concerned the boundary of Bessarabia, a territory to be given back by Russia to Ottoman Moldavia. Palmerston, supported by Austria, took a tough line, arguing that Russia must not have any means of access to the Danube, the key Austrian anxiety. The Russians wanted to use Kars as a counterweight to Bessarabia, and the French supported them. But under pressure from the British and the Austrians, Napoleon persuaded Orlov to accept a compromise at Paris. Overall, the Russians lost about a third of the Bessarabian land they had taken from the Turks in 1812, including the Danube Delta. But they retained the Bulgarian communities of Bessarabia and the strategically important mountain ridge running southeast from Khotyn. The British claimed a victory. Austria celebrated the liberation of the Danube, and the Russians felt the loss of southern Bessarabia as a national humiliation. It was the first territory the Russians had ceded to the Turks since the 17th century. On the other major issues, the powers largely came to terms before the Paris Congress met, guided by the 4 points agreed by the Allies in 1854. The British had attempted to add a 5th point that would take away from Russia all its lands in the southern Caucasus, Circassia, Georgia, Erivan and Nakhichevan. But the Russians insisted that they held these territories by the Treaty of Adrianople, and the Turks backed up their claims. However, the Russians were forced to surrender Kars. They also lost out in their efforts to avoid the full effect of the 3rd point, the demilitarization of the Black Sea, by negotiating an exclusion for Nikolaev, 20 kilometers inland from the coastline on the Bug River, and for the Sea of Azov. On the question of the 2 Danubian principalities, the main subject of the 1st point, there was a lively exchange of ideas. The British were broadly in favour of restoring Ottoman control. The French gave their backing to the Romanian liberals and nationalists who wanted to unite the principalities as an independent state. The Austrians were flatly opposed to the establishment of a nation-state on their southeastern border, as they had significant Slav minorities with national aspirations of their own. The Austrians rightly suspected that the French were backing the Romanians as a way of putting pressure on the Austrians to give up their interests in northern Italy. The 3 powers all agreed to end the Russian protectorate over the Danubian principalities and to guarantee the free commercial navigation of the Danube, the 2nd point. But they could not agree on what to replace it with, other than the collective guarantee of the great powers under the nominal sovereignty of the Ottoman Empire, with vague plans for elections at some point in the future to determine the views of the population in Moldavia and Wallachia. As for the question of protecting the Christian subjects of the Ottoman Empire, the fourth point, representatives of the Allied powers met with the Grand Vizier Ali Pasha and the Tanzimat reformer Fuad Pasha, the Sultan's delegates to the Paris Congress, in Constantinople in early January, to impress on them the need for the Porte to show that it was serious about granting full religious and civil equality to the empire's non-Muslims, including Jews. Reporting on the conference to Clarendon on the 9th of January, Stratford Canning was sceptical about the Turkish minister's expressions of commitment to reform. He thought they were resentful of the foreign imposition of reform, that they saw it as undermining Ottoman sovereignty, and concluded that it would be difficult to get any protection for the Christians implemented properly. The Turks had always lived in the belief that the Christians were inferior, and no law passed by the Sultan could overcome that prejudice in the short period of time expected by the West. "We may expect procrastination on the ground of respect of religious antipathies, popular prejudices, and unassociating habits," wrote the veteran diplomat, who further warned that forcing through reforms might lead to a revolt by the Muslims against the Sultan's westernizing policies. In response to a 21-point draft program presented by the Allies' representatives, the Sultan issued the Hati Humayun on the 18th of February. The decree promised to his non-Muslim subjects full religious and legal equality, rights of property, and open entry on merit to the Ottoman military and civil service. The Turks hoped that the reform would prevent any further European intervention into Ottoman affairs. They wanted the Hati Humayun excluded from the Paris talks on the grounds of Turkish sovereignty. But the Russians, who had been named in the fourth point as one of the five great powers that would guarantee the security of the Sultan's Christian subjects, insisted that the issue was brought up. They were satisfied with the compromise solution, an international declaration joined by the Porte on the importance of Christian rights in the Ottoman Empire, and in their domestic propaganda the Russians even used it as a symbol of their moral victory in the Crimean War. In one sense, they were right, insofar as the Paris Congress restored the status quo in the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem and the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, as Russia had demanded on behalf of the Greeks against the Latin claims, a point made by the Tsar many times. In a manifesto published on the day the peace was signed, Alexander invoked Providence for bringing to pass the original and principal aim of the war. "Russians, your efforts and sacrifices have not been in vain." Finally, there was the unspoken question of Poland. The idea of restoring Polish independence from Russia had first been advanced among the wartime Allied diplomats by Walewski, the son of Napoleon I, by the Polish Countess Marie Walewska. After the capture of Sevastopol, the French emperor wanted to do something for Poland. An independent Polish kingdom fitted the Napoleonic ideal of a new Europe based on nation-states to overthrow the 1815 settlement. At first, Napoleon III supported Czartoryski's program for the restoration of Congress Poland, the autonomous kingdom established by the Vienna Treaty, whose freedoms had been undermined by the Russians. Later on, as the pre-Congress talks got underway and it became apparent that none of the other powers would come out in favour of the Poles, Napoleon gave his backing to Czartoryski's pared-down list of conditions for Polish language rights and the defence of Poland against Russification. But Orlov would have none of this, insisting that Russia's rights in Poland were based not on the 1815 treaty, but on the Russian conquest of Poland during the suppression of the Polish insurrection of 1830-31. In the interests of improving his relations with Russia, whose support would be needed against the Austrians in Italy, Napoleon decided to give up on the Poles. Nothing more was said about the Polish question at the Paris Congress. Even Palmerston, who rarely missed a chance to confront Russia, advised Clarendon not to make an issue of the Poles. "It would not be expedient," he explained, "to require Russia to restore the Kingdom of Poland. The advantage to the Poles would be very doubtful. If they could be made independent of Russia, that indeed would be a great advantage both for the Poles and for Europe. But the difference either for the Poles or for Europe between the present condition of the Kingdom of Poland and that which was established by the Treaty of Vienna would be hardly worth all the difficulties which we should have to encounter in endeavouring to carry such a change into effect. The Russian government would say, as it said in former years, that Poland had rebelled and was conquered, and that, consequently, it is held now by right of conquest and not by the Treaty of Vienna, and that Russia, therefore, is freed from the obligation of that treaty. The Russians would, moreover, say that to make such a demand is to interfere in the internal affairs of Russia. "Poor Poland," remarked Stratford Canning to Lord Harrowby, one of Czartoryski's supporters. "Her revival is a regular Flying Dutchman. Never is, always to be." With all the major issues resolved beforehand, the Paris Congress proceeded smoothly without any major arguments. Just 3 sessions were required to draft the settlement. There was plenty of spare time for a full range of social engagements, banquets, dinners, concerts, balls and receptions, and a special celebration to mark the birth of the Prince Imperial, Louis Napoleon, the only child of Napoleon III and the Empress Eugenie, before the diplomats finally assembled for the formal signing of the peace treaty at 1 o'clock on Sunday, the 30th of March. Announcements of the peace were made throughout Paris. Telegraphs worked overtime to spread the news across the world. At 2 o'clock, the ending of the war was signalled by a thunderous cannonade fired by the guns at Les Invalides. Cheering crowds assembled in the streets, restaurants and cafes did a roaring trade, and in the evening the Paris sky was lit by fireworks. The next day there was a parade on the Champ de Mars. French troops passed by the Emperor and Prince Napoleon, senior French commanders and foreign dignitaries watched by tens of thousands of Parisians. "There was an electrical tremor of excitement in the crowd," claimed the official history of the Congress, published the next year, "and from the people there was a deafening cheer of national pride and enthusiasm that filled the Champ de Mars better than 1,000 cannon could." Here was the glory and popular acclaim Napoleon had wanted when he went to war. News of the peace arrived in the Crimea the next day, as long as it took for the telegram to be relayed from Paris to Varna and communicated by the underwater cable to Balaclava. On the 2nd of April, the Allied guns in the Crimea were fired for the final time, in salute to mark the end of the war. 6 months were given to the Allies to evacuate their armed forces. The British used the port of Sevastopol, where they oversaw the destruction of the magnificent docks by a series of explosions, while the French destroyed Fort Nicholas. There were enormous quantities of war materiel to be counted, loaded onto ships and taken home. Captured guns and cannon, munitions, scrap metal and food supplies, including vast amounts of booty from the Russians. It was a complicated logistical operation to allocate it all to the various departments of the ministries of war, and many things were left behind, sold off to the Russians, or, like the English wooden huts and barracks, donated to them on condition that they were used for the inhabitants of the Crimea who had been made homeless by the war. The Russians accepted the English offer, but kept the huts and barracks for the army. "It is an enormous endeavour to carry off in just a few months everything that was brought here over a period of 2 years," wrote Captain Herbe to his family on the 28th of April. "A large number of the horses and mules will have to be abandoned or sold off cheaply to the population of the Crimea, and I don't count on ever seeing mine again." The animals were not the only means of transport to be sold off privately. The Balaclava Railway was purchased by a company established by Sir Culling Eardley and Moses Montefiore, who wanted to use the equipment to build a new railroad between Jaffa and Jerusalem, a communication that would civilize and develop the resources of a district now wild and disorderly, according to Palmerston, who authorized the sale. It would serve the growing traffic of religious pilgrims to the Holy Lands. The Jaffa Railway was never built, and in the end, the Balaclava line was sold to the Turks as scrap. Considering how long it took to ship all these supplies to the Crimea, the evacuation was completed speedily. By the 12th of July, Codrington was ready to hand over possession of Balaclava to the Russians before departing with the final British troops on HMS Algiers. A stickler for military etiquette, the Commander-in-Chief was offended by the low rank and appearance of the Russian delegation sent to meet him and receive control of Balaclava. There were about 30 Cossacks of the Don mounted and about 50 infantry, but such a lot! I could not have conceived the Russians would have sent such a dirty specimen of their troops. Never were there such figures in grey coats, so badly armed, too. Disreputable-looking. We were all surprised and amused. I hope they intended to insult us by such specimens. If so, it must have rather turned the tables if they heard the remarks. The guard marched on board, the Russians posted their sentries, and the evacuation was completed. Left behind in the Crimea were the remains of many thousands of soldiers. During the last weeks before their departure, the Allied troops laboured hard to build graveyards and erect memorials to those comrades they would leave behind. In one of his last reports from the Crimea, William Russell described the military cemeteries. The Kerensk is covered with isolated graves, with longer burial grounds, and detached cemeteries from Balaclava to the verge of the roadstead of Sevastopol. Ravine and plain, hill and hollow, the roadside and secluded valley, for miles around, from the sea to the Chernaya, present those stark white stones, singly or in groups, stuck upright in the arid soil, or just peering over the rank vegetation which springs from beneath them. The French have taken but little pains with their graves. One large cemetery has been formed with great care and good taste near the old Inkerman camp, but in general our allies have not enclosed their burial places. The burial ground of the non-commissioned officers and men of the Brigade of Guards is enclosed by a substantial wall. It is entered by a handsome double gate, ingeniously constructed of wood and iron hoops, hammered out straight and painted, which is hinged on two massive pillars of cut stone, with ornamental capitals, each surmounted by a cannonball. There are six rows of graves, each row containing 30 or more bodies. Over each of these is either a tombstone or a mound, fenced in by rows of white stones, with the initials or sometimes the name of him who lies below, marked on the mound by means of pebbles. Facing the gate and close to it stands a large stone cross. There are but few monumental stones in this cemetery. One is a stone cross with the inscription, "Sacred to the Memory of Lieutenant A. Hill, 22nd Regiment, who died June the 22nd, 1855. This stone was erected by his friends in the Crimea. Another is in memory of Sergeant Major Rennie, 93rd Highlanders, erected by a friend. Another is to Quartermaster J. MacDonald, 72nd Regiment, who died on the 16th of September from a wound received in the trenches before Sevastopol on the 8th of December, aged 35 years. After the Allied armies left, the Russians, who had withdrawn towards Perekop during their evacuation, moved back to the southern towns and plains of the Crimea. The battlefields of the Crimean War returned to farms and grazing lands. Cattle roamed across the graveyards of the Allied troops. Gradually, the Crimea recovered from the economic damage of the war. Sevastopol was rebuilt, roads and bridges were repaired, but in other ways, the peninsula was permanently changed. Most dramatically, the Tatar population had largely disappeared. Small groups had begun to leave their farms at the start of the conflict, but their numbers grew towards the end of the war, in line with their fear of reprisals by the Russians after the departure of the Allied troops. There had already been reprisals for the atrocities at Kerch, with mass arrests, confiscations of property, and summary executions of suspicious Tatars by the Russian military. The inhabitants of the Baidar Valley petitioned Codrington to help them leave the Crimea, fearing what would happen to them if their villages should fall into the hands of the Russians. as our past experience of them gives us little ground to hope for good treatment. Written and translated into English by a local Tatar scribe, their supplication continued. In return for the kindness shown us by the English, we should as soon cease to remember God as to forget Her Majesty Queen Victoria and General Codrington, for whom we will pray the 5 times a day that the Mahometan religion enjoins us to say our prayers, and our prayers to preserve them, and the whole English nation shall be handed down to our children's children. Signed in the names of the priests and nobles and inhabitants of the following 12 villages, Baidar, Sagtik, Kalendi, Skelia, Savatka, Baga, Urkusta, Uzunyu, Buyuk, Luskomia, Kiatu, Kuchuk, Luskomiga, Varnutka. Codrington did nothing to help the Tatars, even though they had provided the Allies with foodstuffs, spies, and transport services throughout the Crimean War. The idea of protecting the Tatars against Russian reprisals never crossed the minds of the Allied diplomats, who might have included a stronger clause about their treatment in the peace treaty. Article 5 of the Paris Treaty obliged all warring nations to give full pardon to those of their subjects who appeared guilty of actively participating in the military affairs of the enemy, a clause that appeared to protect not only the Crimean Tatars, but the Bulgarians and Greeks of the Ottoman Empire, who had sided with the Russians during the Danubian campaigns. But Count Stroganov, the Governor-General of New Russia, found a way around this clause by claiming that the Tatars had lost their treaty rights if they had broken Russian law by departing from their place of residence without prior approval from the military authorities, as tens of thousands of them had been forced to do during the Crimean War. In other words, any Tatar who had left his home without a stamp in his passport was deemed to be a traitor by the Russian government and was subject to penal exile in Siberia. As the Allied armies began their evacuation of the Crimea, the first large groups of Tatars also left. On the 22nd of April, 4,500 Tatars set sail from Balaklava for Constantinople in the belief that the Turkish government had invited them to relocate in the Ottoman Empire. Alarmed by the mass exodus, which was a threat to the Crimean agricultural economy, Russian local officials looked for guidance from St. Petersburg as to whether they should stop the departure of the Tatars. Having been informed that the Tatars had collaborated en masse with the enemy, the Tsar responded that nothing should be done to prevent their exodus, adding that, in fact, it would be advantageous to rid the peninsula of this harmful population, a concept reenacted by Stalin during the Second World War. Communicating Alexander's statement to his officials, Stroganov interpreted it as a direct order for the expulsion of the Muslim population from the Crimea by claiming that the Tsar had said that it was necessary and not just advantageous to make the Tatars leave. Various pressures were applied to encourage their departure. There were rumours of a planned mass deportation to the north, of Cossack raids on Tatar villages, of campaigns to force the Tatars to learn Russian in Crimean schools or to convert to Christianity. Taxes were increased on Tatar farms, and Tatar villages were deprived of access to water, forcing them to sell their land to Russian landowners. Between 1856 and 1863, about 150,000 Crimean Tatars and perhaps 50,000 Nogai Tatars, roughly two-thirds of the combined Tatar population of the Crimea and southern Russia, emigrated to the Ottoman Empire. Precise figures are hard to calculate, and some historians have put the figures much higher. Concerned about growing labour shortages in the region, in 1867 the Russian authorities tried to work out from police statistics how many Tatars had left the peninsula since the ending of the war. It was reported that 104,211 men and 88,149 women had left the Crimea. There were 784 deserted villages and 457 abandoned mosques. Along with the removal of the Tatar population, the Russian authorities pursued a policy of Christianizing the Crimea after 1856. More than ever, as a direct consequence of the Crimean War, they saw the peninsula as a religious borderland between Russia and the Muslim world, over which they needed to consolidate their hold. Before the war, the relatively liberal Governor-General, Prince Vorontsov, had opposed the spread of Christian institutions to the Crimea on the grounds that it would germinate among the Tatar natives unfounded dangerous thoughts about intentions of deflecting them from Islam and converting them to orthodoxy. But Vorontsov retired from his post in 1855, to be replaced by the aggressively Russian nationalist Stroganov, who actively supported the Christianizing goals of Innocenti, the Archbishop of the Kherson-Taurid diocese, within which the Crimea fell. Towards the end of the Crimean War, Innocenti's sermons had been widely circulated to the Russian troops in the form of pamphlets and illustrated prints, lubki. Innocenti portrayed the conflict as a holy war for the Crimea, the centre of the nation's Orthodox identity, where Christianity had arrived in Russia. Highlighting the ancient heritage of the Greek Church and the peninsula, he depicted the Crimea as a Russian Athos, a sacred place in the Holy Russian Empire, connected by religion to the monastic centre of Orthodoxy on the peninsula of Mount Athos in northeastern Greece. With Stroganov's support, Innocenti oversaw the creation of a separate bishopric for the Crimea, as well as the establishment of several new monasteries in the peninsula after the Crimean War. To encourage the Christian settlement of the Crimea, the Tsarist government introduced a law in 1862 granting special rights and subsidies to colonists from Russia and abroad. Land abandoned by the Tatars was set aside for sale to foreigners. The influx of new Christian populations during the 1860s and 1870s transformed the ethnic profile of the Crimea. What had once been Tatar settlements were now populated by Russians, Greeks, Armenians, Bulgarians, even Germans and Estonians, all of them attracted by promises of cheap and fertile land or by special rights of entry into urban guilds and corporations not ordinarily available to newcomers. Armenians and Greeks turned Sevastopol and Yevpatoria into major trading centres, while older Tatar towns like Kefe, Feodosia, Gözleve and Bakhchisaray fell into decline. Many of the rural immigrants were Bulgarian or other Christian refugees from Bessarabia, territory ceded by the Russians to the Turks after the Crimean War. They were settled by the government in 330 villages once occupied by the Tatars and were helped financially to transform mosques into churches. Meanwhile, many of the Tatars who had fled from the Crimea were resettled on the lands abandoned by the Christians in Bessarabia. All around the Black Sea Rim, the Crimean War resulted in the uprooting and transmigration of ethnic and religious groups. They crossed in both directions over the religious line separating Russia from the Muslim world. Greeks emigrated in their tens of thousands from Moldavia and Bessarabia to southern Russia after the Crimean War. Moving in the opposite direction from Russia into Turkey were tens of thousands of Polish refugees and soldiers who had fought in the Polish Legion, the so-called Ottoman Cossacks, against Russia in the Crimea and the Caucasus. They were settled by the port on Turkish lands in the Dobruja region of the Danube Delta, in Anatolia and other areas, while others ended up in Adampol, Polonezkoy, the Polish settlement established by Adam Czartoryski, the leader of the Polish emigration on the outskirts of Constantinople in 1842. On the other side of the Black Sea, tens of thousands of Christian Armenians left their homes in Anatolia and emigrated to Russian-controlled Transcaucasia in the wake of the Crimean War. They were fearful that the Turks would see them as allies of the Russians and carry out reprisals against them. The European Commission, appointed by the Paris Treaty to fix the Russian-Ottoman border, found Armenian villages half-inhabited and churches in a state of advanced decay. Meanwhile, even larger numbers of Circassians, Abkhazians, and other Muslim tribes were forced out of their homelands by the Russians, who, after the Crimean War, stepped up their military campaign against Shamil, engaging in a concerted policy of what today would be defined as ethnic cleansing to Christianize the Caucasus. The campaign was largely driven by the strategic demands created by the Paris settlement in the Black Sea, where the Royal Navy could freely operate and the Russians had no means of self-defense in their vulnerable coastal areas where the Muslim population was hostile to Russia. The Russians focused first on the fertile lands of Circassia in the western Caucasus, territories close to the Black Sea coast. Muslim villages were attacked by Russian troops, men and women massacred, farms and homes destroyed to force the villagers to leave or starve. The Circassians were presented with the choice of moving north to the Kuban Plains, far enough away from the coastal areas for them not to be a threat in case of an invasion, or emigrating to the Ottoman Empire. Tens of thousands resettled in the north, but equally large numbers of Circassians were herded by the Russians to the Black Sea ports, where, sometimes after weeks of waiting by the docks in terrible conditions, they were loaded onto Turkish boats and taken off to Trebizond, Samsun and Sinope in Anatolia. The Ottoman authorities were unprepared for the mass influx of refugees, and several thousands of them died from disease within months of their arrival in Turkey. By 1864, the Muslim population of Circassia had been entirely cleared. The British consul, C.H. Dixon, claimed that one could walk a whole day in formerly Circassian territories and not meet a living soul. After the Circassians, it was the turn of the Abkhazian Muslims, at that time settled in the Sukhumi-Kale region, where the Russian campaign to clear them off their lands began in 1866. The tactics were essentially the same as those employed against the Circassians, except this time the Russians had a policy of keeping back the able-bodied male workers out of fear for the economy and forcing out their women, children and the elderly. The British consul and Arabic scholar William Gifford Palgrave, who made a tour of Abkhazia to collect information on the ethnic cleansing, estimated that three-quarters of the Muslim population had been forced to emigrate. Overall, counting both Circassians and Abkhazians, around 1.2 million Muslims were expelled from the Caucasus in the decade following the Crimean War, most of them resettling in the Ottoman Empire. And by the end of the 19th century, the Muslims of these two regions were outnumbered by new Christian settlers by more than 10 to 1. As a signal of his intention to grant religious toleration, the Sultan agreed to attend two foreign balls in the Turkish capital, one at the British Embassy, the other at the French, in February 1856. It was the first time in the history of the Ottoman Empire that a Sultan had accepted invitations to a Christian entertainment in the house of a foreign ambassador. Abdulmajid arrived at the British Embassy wearing the Order of the Garter, presented to him a few weeks before, to mark the Allied victory. Stratford Canning, the ambassador, met the Sultan at the carriage door. As the Sultan alighted, a signal was transmitted by electrical wire to the British fleet, anchored in the Bosporus, which saluted them with pronged salvos of cannon. It was a costume ball, and princes, pirates, musketeers, fake Circassians and shepherdesses were in attendance. Lady Hornby wrote down her impressions the next day. "It would take me a day to enumerate half the costumes, but everyone who had been to the Queen's Bal Costume agreed that they did not approach this one in magnificence. For besides the gathering of French, Sardinian, and English officers, the people of the country appeared in their own superb and varied costumes, and the groups were beyond all description beautiful. The Greek patriarch, the Armenian archbishop, the Jewish high priest were there in their robes of state. Real Persians, Albanians, Kurds, Serbians, Armenians, Greeks, Turks, Austrians, Sardinians, Italians, and Spaniards were there in their different dresses, and many wore their jeweled arms. Abdul-Majid quietly walked up the ballroom with Lord and Lady Stratford, their daughters, and the gorgeous array of pashas in the rear. He paused with evident delight and pleasure at the really beautiful scene before him, bowing on both sides and smiling as he went. Pashas drink vast quantities of champagne, of which they pretend not to know the exact genus, and slyly call it eau gazeuse. At the ball at the French embassy, the Sultan appeared wearing the medal of the Légion d'honneur that had been presented to him by Touvenel, the French ambassador. Welcomed by a military salute, he talked to foreign dignitaries and moved among the dancers, who improvised to the Turkish marches performed by the army band. One of the things that pleased the Sultan most at these events was the appearance of the European women, whose dress he claimed greatly to prefer to that of Muslim women. "If socializing with these ladies is like their outer appearance," he told his Austrian physician, "then I certainly envy you Europeans." Encouraged by the Sultan, palace women and high officials' wives began to adopt more elements of Western dress: corsets, silk capes, and transparent veils. They appeared more often in society and socialized more frequently with men. Domestic culture was also westernized, with the appearance of European table manners, cutlery and crockery, furniture and decorative styles in the homes of the European elites in Constantinople. In almost every sphere of life, the Crimean War marked a watershed in the opening up and westernization of Turkish society. The mass influx of refugees from the Russian Empire was only one of the many ways in which the Ottoman Empire became more exposed to external influence. The Crimean War brought new ideas and technologies into the Ottoman world, accelerated Turkey's integration into the global economy, and greatly increased contacts between Turks and foreigners. More Europeans came to Constantinople during and immediately after the Crimean War than at any other time in its previous history. The many diplomats, financiers, military advisers and soldiers, engineers, tourists, merchants, missionaries and priests left a deep impression on Turkish society. The war also led to a vast expansion of foreign capital investment in the Ottoman Empire, and with it an increase in Turkey's financial dependence on Western banks and governments. Foreign loans to finance the war and the Tanzimat reforms spiralled from about £5 million in 1855 to a staggering £200 million by 1877. It stimulated the development of telegraphs and railways and accelerated the emergence of what might be called Turkish public opinion through newspapers and a new type of journalistic writing that came about directly as a result of the huge demand for information during the Crimean War. With the new Ottomans, Yeni Osmanlılar, a loose group of journalists and would-be reformers who briefly came together in something like a political party during the 1860s, the war also triggered a reaction against some of these changes and fostered the emergence of the first Ottoman-Turkish nationalist movement. The new Ottomans' belief in adopting Western institutions within a framework of Muslim tradition made them, in many ways, the spiritual fathers of the Young Turks, the creators of the modern Turkish state. The new Ottomans were opposed to the growing intervention of the European powers in the Ottoman Empire. They were against reforms which they believed had been imposed on Turkey by Western governments to promote the special interests of Christians. In particular, they disapproved of the Hati Humayun Decree of 1856, which had indeed been imposed by the European powers. The decree was written by Stratford Canning, along with Touvenel, and then presented to the Porte as a condition of the continuation of foreign loans. It reiterated the principles of religious toleration articulated in the Hati Sharif of 1839, but defined them more clearly in Western legal terms without reference to the Quran. In addition to promising tolerance and civil rights for non-Muslims, it introduced some new political principles to Ottoman governance stipulated by the British: strict annual budgets by the government, the establishment of banks, the codification of criminal and civil law, the reform of Turkish prisons and mixed courts to oversee a majority of cases involving Muslims and non-Muslims. It was a thoroughgoing programme of westernisation for the Ottoman Empire. The new Ottomans had supported the principles contained in the Hati Sharif of 1839 as a necessary element of the Tanzimat reforms. Unlike the decree of 1856, it had some domestic origins and had not threatened the privileged position of Islam in the Ottoman Empire. But they saw the Hati Humayun as a special dispensation for the non-Muslims conceded under pressure by the great powers, and they feared that it would compromise the interests of Islam and Turkish sovereignty. The foreign origins and terminology of the Hati Humayun stirred even greater resentment among Muslim clerics and conservatives. Even the old Tanzimat reformer, Mustafa Rashid, who returned for a brief spell as Grand Vizier after Stratford had insisted on his reappointment in November 1856, thought it went too far in its concessions to the Christians. Angered by the Hati Humayun, a group of Muslim theologians and students plotted a conspiracy against the Sultan and his ministers, but they were arrested in 1859. Under interrogation, their leaders claimed that the Hati Humayun was a contravention of Sharia law because it had granted Christians equal rights to Muslims. Sheikh Ahmet, one of the main conspirators, claimed that the Christians had obtained these rights only through the help of foreign powers, and that the concessions would mean the end of the privileged position of Islam in the Ottoman Empire. Their views were shared by many power holders and beneficiaries of the old Muslim hierarchy, local pashas, governors, landowners and notables, clerics and officials, tax farmers and money lenders, who were all afraid that the better educated and more active Christian minorities would soon come to dominate the political and social order if they were granted civil and religious equality. For centuries, the Muslims of the empire had been told that the Christians were inferior. Faced with the loss of their privileged position, the Muslims became increasingly rebellious. There were riots and attacks by Muslims against Christians in Bessarabia, in Nablus and in Gaza in 1856, in Jaffa during 1857, in the Hejaz during 1858, and in Lebanon and Syria, where 20,000 Maronite Christians were massacred by Druzes and Muslims during 1860. In each case, religious and economic divisions reinforced each other. The livelihood of Muslims engaged in agriculture and small trades was directly threatened by the import of European goods by Christian middlemen. Rioters attacked Christian shops and houses, foreign churches and missionary schools, even embassies, after they had been stirred up by Muslim clerics opposed to the Hati Humayun. In Nablus, to take just one example, the troubles began on the 4th of April, shortly after Muslim leaders had denounced the Hati Humayun at Friday prayers. There were 5,000 Christians in Nablus, a town of 10,000 people, and before the Crimean War, they had lived peacefully with the Muslims. But the war had increased tensions between them. The defeat of Russia was seen as a Muslim victory by the local Palestinians, whose religious pride was offended by the new laws of religious toleration in the Hati Humayun. Christians, for their part, saw it as an allied triumph. They raised French and British flags on their houses in Nablus and placed a new bell over the Protestant mission school. These were provocations to Islamic sentiment. At Friday prayers, the ulamas condemned these signs of Western domination, arguing that Muslims would soon be called to prayer by the English bell unless they rose up to destroy the Christian churches, which, they said, would be a proper form of prayer to God. Calling for jihad, crowds spilled out onto the streets of Nablus, many of them gathering by the Protestant mission, where they tore down the British flag. Amid these heightened tensions, violence was sparked by a bizarre incident involving the Reverend Mr. Lyde, a Protestant missionary and fellow of Jesus College, Cambridge, who had accidentally shot a beggar attempting to steal his coat. "The cup of fanaticism was full, and one drop more caused it to run over," wrote James Finn, the British consul in Jerusalem, who reported on the incident. Lied had taken refuge from the mob in the house of the town governor, Mahmoud Bek, who pacified the family of the dead man and proposed to bury him. But the ulemas were not satisfied with this. After a religious council, they forbade the burial and suspended public prayers in all the mosques until the price of the blood of Islam should be paid. Calling for vengeance on the Christians, a large crowd assembled outside the governor's house and demanded to be given Lied, who offered to sacrifice himself, but Mahmoud Bek refused, whereupon the mob began to rampage through the town, pillaging and destroying any property on which they could lay their hands. Christian houses, schools and churches were ransacked and burned. Several Prussian consular officials were murdered, along with a dozen Greeks, according to Finn, who also reported that 11 women are known to have given premature birth to infants from the effect of fright. Order was eventually restored by the intervention of the Sultan's troops, and on the 21st of April, Lied was put on trial in a Turkish court in Jerusalem, where a mixed Muslim and Christian jury acquitted him of murder, but ordered him to pay a large sum in compensation to the beggar's family. Lied returned to England in a deranged mental state. He had delusions of himself as Christ. The ringleaders of the Muslim riots were never brought to trial, and attacks on Christians in the area continued for many months. In August 1856, the violence spread from Nablus to Gaza. In February 1857, Finn reported that 300 Christians were still living in a state of terror in Gaza, for no one could control the Muslim fanatics, and the Christians would not testify for fear of reprisals. Faced with the prospect of this sort of violence almost anywhere, the Ottoman authorities dragged their heels over implementing the new laws of religious toleration in the Hatti Humayun. Stratford Canning was increasingly frustrated with the port. "Turkish ministers are very little disposed to meet the demands of Her Majesty's government on the subjects of religious persecution," he wrote to Clarendon. "They pretend to entertain apprehensions of popular discontent among the Muslims if they were to give way." Turkish participation in the Crimean War had led to a resurgence of Muslim triumphalism, Stratford reported. As a result of the war, the Turks had become more protective of their sovereignty and more resentful of Western intervention into their affairs. There was a new generation of Tanzimat reformers at the head of the Turkish government who were more secure in their personal position and less dependent on the patronage of foreign powers and ambassadors than Reshid's generation of reformers had been before the Crimean War. They could afford to be more cautious and more practical in their implementation of reforms, carrying out the economic and political requirements of the Western powers, but not hurrying to fulfil the religious promises contained in the Hatti Humayun. Throughout this last year as ambassador, Stratford urged the Turkish leaders to be more serious about the protection of the Christians in the Ottoman Empire. It was the price, he told them, that Turkey had to pay for British and French help in the Crimean War. He was particularly exercised by the continuing execution of Muslims for converting to Christianity, despite the Sultan's promises to secure the Christians from religious persecution and abolish the barbarous practice of putting seceders to death. Citing numerous cases of Christian converts being driven from their homes and killed, Stratford wrote to the port on the 23rd of December, 1856. "The great European powers can never consent to perpetuate by the triumphs of their fleets and armies the enforcement in Turkey of a law, apostasy, which is not only a standing insult to them, but a source of cruel persecution to their fellow Christians. They are entitled to demand, the British government distinctly demands, that the Mohammedan who turns Christian shall be as free from every kind of punishment on that account as the Christian who embraces the Mohammedan faith." Yet by the time of his return to London the next year, very little had been done by the port to satisfy the demands of the European governments. "Among the Christians," Finn reported in July 1857, "a strong feeling of discontent is on the increase because of the slowness of the Turkish government to implement religious toleration. The Christians complain that they are insulted in the streets, that they are not placed in equal rank at public courts with Muslim fellow subjects, that they are ousted from almost every office of government employment, and that they are not allowed the honour of military service, but instead of it have the old military tax doubled upon them. In the rural areas of Palestine, according to Finn, the Hati Humayun remained unobserved for many years. Local governors were corrupt, ill-disciplined, and closely linked to the Muslim notables, clerics and officials who kept the Christians in their place, while the port was too remote and weak to curb their excesses, let alone to force them to uphold the new laws of equality. But it was in the Balkans that the failure of the port to carry out reforms would have the most lasting consequences for the Ottoman Empire. Throughout the Balkan region, Christian peasants would rise up against their Muslim landlords and officials, beginning in Bosnia in 1858. The continuation of the millet system would give rise to nationalist movements that would involve the Ottomans and the European powers in a long series of Balkan wars, culminating in the conflicts that would bring about the First World War. The Paris Treaty did not make any major territorial changes to the map of Europe. To many at the time, the outcome did not appear worthy of a war in which so many people died. Russia ceded southern Bessarabia to Moldavia, but otherwise the treaty's articles were statements of principle. The independence and integrity of the Ottoman Empire were confirmed and guaranteed by the great powers, the first time a Muslim state was recognized by international law, the Congress of Vienna having specifically excluded Turkey from the European powers regulated by its international laws. The protection of the non-Muslim subjects of the Sultan was guaranteed by the signatory powers, thereby annulling Russia's claims to protect the Christians of the Ottoman Empire. Russia's protectorate over the Danubian principalities was negated by an article confirming the autonomy of these two states under Ottoman sovereignty, and, most humiliating of all for the Russians, Article 11 declared the Black Sea to be a neutral zone, open to commercial shipping, but closed to all warships in peacetime, thus depriving Russia of its naval ports and arsenals on this crucial southern coastal frontier. But if the Paris Treaty made few immediate changes to the European map, it marked a crucial watershed for international relations and politics, effectively ending the old balance of power, in which Austria and Russia had controlled the continent between themselves and forging new alignments that would pave the way for the emergence of nation-states in Italy, Romania, and Germany. Although it was Russia that was punished by the Paris Treaty, in the longer term it was Austria that would lose the most from the Crimean War, despite having barely taken part in it. Without its conservative alliance with Russia, which never quite forgave it for its armed neutrality in favour of the Allies in 1854, and equally mistrusted by the liberal Western powers for its reactionary politics and soft-on-Russia peace initiatives during the war, Austria found itself increasingly isolated on the continent after 1856. Consequently, it would lose out in Italy in the war against the French and Piedmontese in 1859, in Germany in the war against the Prussians in 1866, and in the Balkans, where it steadily retreated from the 1870s until 1914. None of that was yet apparent in April 1856, when Austria joined France and Britain in a triple alliance to defend the Paris settlement. The three powers signed an agreement that any breach of the Paris Treaty would become a cause of war. Palmerston saw it as a good additional security and bond of union against Russia, which he fully expected to re-emerge in due course as a major threat to the continent. He wanted to expand the Entente into an anti-Russian league of European states. Napoleon was not so sure. Since the fall of Sevastopol, there had been a growing rapprochement between the French and the Russians. Napoleon needed Russia for his plans against the Austrians in Italy. Meanwhile, for the Russians, and in particular for their new foreign minister, Alexander Gortchakov, who replaced Nesselrode in 1856, France represented the most likely power to support their efforts to remove the humiliating Black Sea clauses of the Paris Treaty. both France and Russia were revisionist powers. Where Russia wanted revisions to the Treaty of 1856, France wanted to remove the remnants of the 1815 settlement. A deal between them could be made. Unlike Nesselrode, a firm supporter of the Holy Alliance and its legitimist principles, Gorchakov took a pragmatic view of Russia's role on the continent. In his opinion, Russia should not form alliances that committed it to general principles, such as the defence of legitimate monarchies, as it had done before the Crimean War. The war had shown that Russia could not rely in any way on the solidarity of legitimate European monarchies. Nesselrode's policy had made Russia vulnerable to the failings of other governments, Austria in particular, a power Gorchakov despised from his time as ambassador in Vienna. Instead, Gorchakov believed Russia should focus its diplomacy on its own national interests and ally with other powers, regardless of their ideology, to further those interests. Here was a new type of diplomacy, the Realpolitik, later practiced by Bismarck. The Russians tested the Paris Treaty from the start, focusing on minor issues which they could exploit to open up divisions in the Crimean alliance. In May 1856, they claimed ownership of a lighthouse on tiny Serpent Island in Turkish waters near the mouth of the Danube Delta, and landed seven men with an officer to take up residence in the lighthouse. Walewski was inclined to let the Russians have the insignificant island, but Palmerston was adamant that they had to be ejected on the grounds that they were infringing Turkish sovereignty. When the captain of a British ship made contact with the Turks on Serpent Island, he was told that they did not mind the Russians being there. They saw them as guests and were happy to sell them their supplies. Palmerston put his foot down. "We must avoid the fatal mistake made by Aberdeen in permitting the early movements and indications of Russian aggression to go on unnoticed and unrepressed," he wrote to Clarendon on the 7th of August. Orders were prepared to send the gunboats in to remove the Russians physically, but John Woodhouse, the British envoy in St. Petersburg, was doubtful whether Britain had the right to do this, and the Queen shared these doubts. So Palmerston backed down, and diplomatic pressure was used instead. Gorchakov insisted that the island had been owned by the Russians since 1833 and appealed to the French, who were thus manoeuvred into a position of international mediation between Britain and Russia. Meanwhile, the Russians launched a second challenge to the Paris Treaty in connection with the border between Russian Bessarabia and Turkish-controlled Moldavia. By an accident of mapping and confusion over names, the Allies had drawn the border running to the south of an old village called Bolgrad, 3 kilometres to the north of New Bolgrad, a market town situated on the shores of Lake Yalpuk, which runs into the Danube. The Russians made use of the lack of clarity, claiming that they should be given both Bolgrads and thus joint ownership of Lake Yalpuk. Palmerston insisted that the border should remain at the old village, the intention of the treaty having been to deprive the Russians of access to the Danube. He urged the French to remain firm and show a united front against the Russians, who would otherwise exploit their differences. But the French were happy to concede the Russian claim as a matter of good faith, though they then proposed that the boundary should run along a narrow strip of land between the market town and Lake Yalpuk, thereby granting more territory to the Russians but depriving them of access to the lake. Once again, the French acted as intermediaries between Russia and Britain. By mid-November, the Duc de Morny had persuaded Gorchakov to give up Russia's claim to Serpent Island, provided Russia was given New Bolgrad without access to the lake and territorial compensation for their loss in a form decided by the French Emperor. The deal was linked to a proposal by the Tsar and Gorchakov, drawn up with the help of Morny in St. Petersburg, for a Franco-Russian convention for the protection of the neutrality of the Black Sea and the Danubian principalities, as set out in the Paris Treaty, but now necessitated, it was claimed by the Russians, by the fact that the treaty had been violated by England and Austria, who had tried to cheat the Russians of legitimate possessions in the Danube area. Morny recommended the Russian proposal to Napoleon and passed on to the French emperor a promise made to him by Gorchakov. Russia would support French acquisitions on the European continent if France signed the convention. "Mark well," Morny wrote, "Russia is the only power that will ratify the territorial gains of France. I have already been assured of that. Try and get the same from the English. And who knows, with our demanding and capricious people, one day we might have to come to Russia for their satisfaction." Details of the Russian attitude to French territorial acquisitions had been outlined in a secret instruction to Count Kisilev, the former governor of the Danubian principalities who became ambassador to France after the Crimean War. Protocol required that a senior statesman represent the Tsar's new policy of friendship towards France. Should Napoleon direct his attention to the Italian peninsula, Kisilev was told, Russia would consent in advance to the reunion of Nice and Savoy with France, as well as to the union of Lombardy with Sardinia. If his ambitions were directed to the Rhine, Russia would use its good offices to help the French while continuing to honour its commitments to Prussia. A conference of the powers representatives in Paris brought about a speedy resolution of the two disputes in January 1857. Turkish ownership of Serpent Island was confirmed with an international commission to control the lighthouse, and New Bolgrad was given to Moldavia, with Russia compensated by a boundary change elsewhere in Bessarabia. On the face of it, the Russians had been forced to back down on both issues, but they had scored a political victory by weakening the bonds of the Crimean alliance. The French had made it clear that the integrity of the Ottoman Empire was of secondary significance to them, and they were ready to enter into a deal with the Russians to redraw the European map. Over the next 18 months, a number of high-level Russian visitors appeared in France. In 1857, the Grand Duke Constantine, the Tsar's younger brother and the admiral in charge of the much-needed reform of the Russian navy after the Crimean War, made a trip to Paris, having decided that a partnership with France was the best way to get the technical assistance Russia needed to modernize its backward fleet. He gave to French firms all the orders that could not be fulfilled by Russian shipbuilders. On his way, he stopped at the Bay of Villafranca near Nice, where he negotiated an agreement with Cavour for the Odessa Shipping Company to rent a coaling station from the Turin government, thereby providing Russia with a foothold in the Mediterranean. Napoleon gave a splendid reception to the Grand Duke in Paris and drew him into private conversations about the future of Europe. The French emperor knew that the Grand Duke was trying to assert himself as a force in Russian foreign policy and that he had Pan-Slav views at odds with those of Gorchakov, so he played to his political ambitions. Napoleon referred specifically to the possibility of an Italian uprising against the Austrians and the eventual unification of Italy under Piedmont's leadership, and talked about the likelihood of Christian uprisings in the Ottoman Empire, a subject of great interest to Constantine, suggesting that in both cases it would suit their interests to encourage the formation of smaller nation-states. Encouraged by the Grand Duke, Napoleon entered into direct contact with the Tsar, with the aim of securing his support for a French Piedmontese war against the Austrians in Italy. Having met the Tsar at Stuttgart in September 1857, Napoleon became so confident of his support that when he met Cavour the following July at Plombières to draw up war plans, he assured the Piedmontese Prime Minister that he had Alexander's solemn promise to back their plans in Italy. After the defeat of the Austrians in Lombardy-Venetia, an enlarged Piedmont would form a kingdom of northern Italy, as had emerged briefly in 1848-9, and become united with Tuscany, a reduced papal state, and the kingdom of the Two Sicilies in an Italian confederation. And for his efforts on behalf of the Italian cause, Napoleon would be rewarded with the return of Nice and Savoy to France. Cavour had pinned his hopes for Italy on the Franco-British alliance. That was why he had committed his Sardinian troops to the Crimean War. At the Paris Congress, he had won the sympathies of the British and the French through his influence behind the scenes, and although he had gained nothing tangible, no firm promise of support for the idea of Italy, he continued to believe that the Western powers were his only hope. Hardly believing that a Russian Tsar would give his blessing to a national revolution, Cavour rushed to the nearby spa resort of Baden-Baden, where the run-down kings and princes of Europe congregated to consult with the Grand Duchess Elena Pavlovna, Alexander's influential liberal aunt, who confirmed that Russia could be counted on. "The Grand Duchess told me," Cavour wrote to General Marmora, "that if France were to unite with us, public opinion would force the Russian government to participate." But in truth, the Tsar was not keen to get involved in any war. In return for French commitment to cancel their support for the Black Sea clauses of the Paris Treaty, Alexander promised only armed neutrality, mobilizing a large Russian force on the border with Galicia to prevent the Austrians from sending troops to Italy. The Austrians had used armed neutrality in favor of the Allies during the Crimean War, and Alexander's decision to follow the same tactic let him take revenge on Austria for its betrayal. Napoleon, for his part, was unwilling to give a firm pledge on the Black Sea clauses, fearing it would damage his relations with Britain, so no formal treaty with the Russians could be reached. But there was a gentleman's agreement between the emperors, signed in March 1859, by which the Russians would adopt a stance of benevolent neutrality in the event of a Franco-Austrian war, in exchange for French good offices at a future date. It was on this basis that the French and Piedmontese began their war against Austria in April 1859, in the knowledge that the Russians would advance 300,000 troops towards the Austrian frontier while they attacked in Italy. Only a few years before, Russia would have given military support to Austria against any French attempt to revise the Vienna Treaty. The Crimean War had changed everything.